we are continuing in our Revelation 11. And let's see, Brother Dan, could you read for us in Revelation 11, verses 3 through 6? And then Sister Betty, could you read verses 7 through 12, please?
Revelation 11, 3 through 6. And I will give unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over water to turn them to blood, and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will.
They have finished their testimony. The beast that comes out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is mystically is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. And those from the people and tribes and tongues and nations will look at their dead bodies for 3.5 days and will not permit their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry, and they will send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. And after the 3.5 days, the breath of life from God came into them, and they stood on their feet, and great fear fell upon those who were beholding them. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up to the heaven in the cloud, and the enemies beheld them.
All right, very good. Thank you. Did anyone have any leftover comments or questions from last week that they wanted to make before we move forward with the study? Okay. So we're currently discussing the 3.5 year period known as the 3.5 days that the two witnesses, the Old and New Testament, were laid dead in the streets, not allowed to be buried, and that the people of the earth who had been tormented by the Old and New Testament were rejoiced that they were disgraced, and the Old and New Testament was disgraced and set aside. And so their death is a result of the beast that shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, had made war against them and killed them. And our 3.5 days represents 3.5 year period, a day for a year. And it is interesting, and we understand why it can be confusing at times. We have a number of 3.5. Notice what I'm saying, 3.5 periods. Sometimes it's 3.5 years. Sometimes it's 3.5 days. It's all very interesting. Sometimes, as you know, it's a time, times, and the dividing of time, a half, 3.5. But it's 1260 years, as you all know. Other times, Jesus had a 3.5 year earthly ministry. Here we have a 3.5 year period of the two witnesses laying dead in the streets, as it were. So that's just a simple observation. 3.5 is obviously half of 7. 3.5 plus 3.5 equals 7. 7 is obviously a deeply spiritual number that is embodied in just about every aspect of natural and spiritual life. God worked 6 days, rested on the seventh. You know, it goes on and on and on. 6,000 years of sin and death followed by a 1,000-year period of the restitution blessing. So again, now that's 7,000. And 7 has that thought of a completion. Sometimes it has associated with that divine approval, a divine number. So the 3.5 is, like I say, it's half of that 7. And we see it used quite predominantly in scripture. So that's more of me just making a simple observation than trying to, I'm not making a case for anything. But I just wanted to emphasize once again, it is understandable that when we talk about the 3.5 literal years, because these are 3.5 symbolic days that they, the two witnesses were dead in the streets, we understand why it's easy to get that mixed up. So we hope that might help be a tool to mentally keep that straight. Okay. So we covered 3 pages of simple notes that I had sent out for us to consider, to think about each of us in how we want to interpret for ourselves these verses that we just had read. We spent a week or two discussing Revelation 17 and a general overview there, because in Revelation 17, we have that phrase about the beast that cometh, that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit, appears there in Revelation chapter 17. So we discussed that. Brother Chris has it in his background, in a sense. And so here, when you and I are making our decisions on how we want to interpret this, and some of us may decide just its exposure, I don't need to draw a hard, fast conclusion now. I'll wait till we get to Revelation 17 and I'll pull it all together. That's all fair and well and good. So I'm trying to keep us moving forward, allowing for questions and comments. I don't want to just get bogged down here because we don't all have to agree. All right. So that being said, maybe what we'll consider first here is, this, I'm calling it a handout that I sent out with those notes, the 3-page notes. You should have that from a few weeks ago. We just want to go through that. The top two, I should have done a screen share, but I didn't. These top two rows, if you will, are a series of 1, 2, 3.5 humps. Though each hump is a year. So it's talking about, it's representing 3.5 years. So the top one, we worked backwards. So look to the far right side. Look to that end of the half year, if you will. And you'll see a date there, March 7th, 1804, and that's the British and Foreign Bible Society was founded. Very clearly recognized, I can't say it's the first Bible society, because you'll see underneath those humps at the top row that we saw on Wikipedia that the French Bible Society was founded in 1792. But ended in 1803 with the Napoleonic Revolution. I wasn't looking for that. I stumbled across that. What I read there about the French Bible Society, it was mainly to try to provide Bibles for seafaring French sailors and such. so they'd have it with them. I don't think it was that huge, but the British and Foreign Bible Society was huge. And then it spawned other efforts in other countries. And so we had our Bible societies in the early 1800s. It's 1804, March 7th is a very marked date to we can use as a beginning. So we worked. I just worked backward from that date. I just went back a half year from March 7th of 1804. I went back a half year to September 7th, 1803. That's not saying anything happened there. It's just creating this chart. And I went back to that, September 7th, 1802, September 7th, 1801, September 7th, 1800. And it's a question mark because it just gets us back. There's nothing there offhand that I saw that would mark the death of the Bible. Hi, Dan, you're open. The death of the Old and New Testament and being in the streets for that period of time. But that is that's one popular view that some fine Bible students have. It's not one I hold to, but I included it because, you know, some of the brethren here attending our meetings might be their view, and I wanted it to be represented. The reasoning that view has is that it ends the 1260 years that of the two witnesses prophesying in sackcloth from Revelation 11 verse 3. It ends in 1799. So then it tells us in verse 7, 11th chapter, verse 7, that when they finish their testimony, the beast that sends out the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them, and their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city and so on for this 3.5 years. So they like the 1260 years of the two witnesses testifying in sackcloth as ending in 1799, the same as the church's persecution of the 1260 year period ending in 1799. And so they have this view, this top view. So I'd leave it there at that. And for those who that appeals to, all well and good. I don't need to make any more comment myself. Did anyone want to comment on this top one? Okay. We'll take it to, you know, the friends grasp it. All right. We've got two more views we'll consider. I didn't get the third view on the chart because I wasn't aware that was going to be, I was aware of the view, but I didn't know that anyone held it in our meeting, attending our meeting, so I didn't entertain it. There are other views as well that I don't think anyone here in our meeting entertained, so I wasn't bringing it out. So I guess I'll go to another view. Let me go to that third view because we can use this. It fits in with this first one somewhat because it has a. It likes that third view, which I'm going to call it's the Brother David Duran view. It's presented in the Louisville notes, and some here have brought it out. It holds.
Brother, go ahead. Cindy's hand is up.
Okay, I'm busy looking at my chart, so I'm sorry. Thank you for bringing that out, Sister Cindy.
I was just going to tell you that I think it was a couple of weeks ago you asked me to look into Mary Jones and her Bible because that one had a question mark. The best I could come up with, there was no definitive date, but they said the journey started in spring of 1800. So I don't know if that will ultimately make your 3.5 years with the question mark starting point. So just wanted to bring that out.
Okay, very nice. Thank you. Well, she's an instrumental young lady. Appreciate that very much. And if anyone hasn't read that, the story about that, it's easy to find, and it's the precursor to the impetus of getting the British Reformed Bible Society up and going. Her testimony of her story was used. Okay. Thank you, Sister Cindy. Any other comments? I'm looking up. Okay. So this, the Louisville view that they present is that they too keep the 1260 years of the two witnesses testifying in sackcloth as the same 1260-year period that the church fled into the wilderness. But they don't have this same sequence at the end. They have an adjustment for their 3.5-year period. However, they do believe that the a convincing point is that the Bible Society beginning in 1804, following after the French Revolution. So we know the French Revolution was 1789 to 1799. It was a 10-year period. The French Revolution itself was very rocky. It wasn't always consistent. There were a change of in leadership and various challenges that they had. Napoleon came up in the midst of that, as it were. He rose to power and eventually became the emperor and so on. But we have the ending of the French Revolution in 1799. So you would have this 3.5-year period ending in the British Foreign and Bible Society. But the Louisville notes recognize that there was no recorded war from 1800 to 1804 against the two witnesses. It was kind of the opposite. The Bible was becoming more appreciated. So what they do, the Louisville notes, is they follow a reasoning that they like from the Uriah Smith book called, what's that title exactly? Daniel. Yes, Daniel and the Revelation. And it's Uriah Smith is a was an Adventist commentator. Excuse me. He wrote this book. And it has good points in it for sure. But they photocopy a couple of pages out of, Uriah Smith's book where he is going verse by verse in Revelation. And they like his summation of what he puts forth as a possible 3.5-year war against the Bible in revolutionary France. And if you have that email I sent out, this would be a good time to take a look at that. And let's skip down, if you will, please, to number two. Item number two, Brother David Durand's notes. So maybe you'll prefer hearing someone else's voice as a change. Don't want you to put you to sleep here. Let's see. Sister Roseanne, do you have that email? Could you read that number two, just that first paragraph, and we'll take a break?
Okay. In Brother Durand's notes, November 1793, a decree passed the French Assembly outlawing religious practice and suppressing the Bible. On June 17, 1797, Camille Jordan, in the Council of the 500, brought up the memorial report on the revision of the laws relative to religious worship. It consisted of a number of propositions abolishing alike the Republican restrictions of popish worship and the popish restriction of Protestant. His notes have several photocopied pages from Brother Uriah Smith's book on the Revelation, which is a verse-by-verse commentary. He is an Adventist. Uriah Smith cites George Storrs, apparently some magazine-style writing pages. George Storrs was also a Bible commentator in the late 1800s. We do not know what George Storrs might have had on the pages cited. However, for the quotes above, Uriah Smith cites George Crowley's work. The Apocalypse of St. John, page 181 to 182. This work can be found online and read. I did find that he was a verse by verse commentator, but that he did not offer further historical sources.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks for correcting my poor English. I did this late last night. I see I sent it out at 10:17 PM. Yeah. So, do you have any opening comment on this, Sister Roseanne? Okay. George Storrs is a name known to us as apparently a godly man known by Brother Russell. And, we have nothing negative about Brother George Storrs, but the pages that seem to be, cited, by Uriah Smith, it has the thought of how it's expressed. It's not the title like of a book. It's called The Midnight Cry, but it has numbers and like page number and such that seems to suggest it's a magazine that went out, just like the Watchtower and Herald of Christ Present went out. It was a magazine. And, that being said, it is not something that I found online that I could see if Brother George Storrs might have had a historical reference that we could consider. My only guess is that there probably isn't. That doesn't make it so. It's a guess. And I emphasize it's a guess. It probably didn't have a historical source because I would guess that Uriah Smith would have cited the historical source as well. So similarly with George Crowley, that is a book. You can find it online. It's free and you can read the pages. And when you do that, you'll see that that too is a verse by verse commentary on Revelation. And while he writes and he makes these statements, it didn't offer historical, evidence as it were. Now, I want to be quick to say that I'm going to read my next little paragraph. Take a look on page 2, just under what Sister Roseanne just read, that little paragraph. So in conclusion, these notes do not offer any historical source. However, I want to be quick to write or say that that does not mean that there is not any historical source. It doesn't mean there isn't a historical source. It means I wasn't finding it on what was provided in the Louisville notes when I chased down as best I could the sources they cited, which was Uriah Smith and then this Mr. George Crowley. And I could get to the Crowley work, as I said. I didn't see that there. But then I'd like us to read this next paragraph, maybe someone else could read it, that has the email. Sister Cheryl, do you have the email? Could you read that next one, please, if you?
Starting with so in conclusion and then the next?
Nope, the next one.
If you search,
please.
If you search on the French Revolution in the Catholic, that's correct?
Yep.
Okay, if you search on the French Revolution in the Catholic Church, you come across many articles and such. it is pretty easy to find the date of October 1793, public worship forbidden. On November 23rd, 1793, churches were closed. However, if you search on the date February 21st, 1795, there was passed into law a reversal for the most part of that previous ban on religious worship. The churches were reopened. Refactory priests were released from jail, and priests were allowed to practice, albeit with a few restrictions. One such source could be found online, History Today, The French Revolution and the Catholic Church, scrolled down to Revolutionary Religion.
Okay, so Sister Cheryl, any opening comments on what this is saying at all?
Well, we do see the 1793 period that we could see this killing off of the unrestricting of our two witnesses. But yet, on the other hand, in 95, we see there was the loosening up of it. So we're trying to put it together. And if this would be the appropriate date to see this 3.5 years, that's what I'm getting from it. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Very good. Anyone else comment on this so far? So then this following next paragraph, Brother Mark Kinkowski, do you have that paper email? Could you read that, please? A little one.
And so then?
Yeah, please.
So then from October 1793 or November 23rd, 1793, when the churches were closed, to February 21st, 1795, when the churches were reopened, was just 1 year and 4 months.
Okay. Any comment at all or just self-explanatory?
Well, I think you're bringing out this period here is not, it might be part of the 2.5 or 3.5 years, but this is not obviously 2.5 years over.
Right. Okay. That's what we wanted to bring out. So I'm going to read that last little paragraph. By the way, Robespierre died in 1794. He was a French lawyer who was very influential in the rejection of religion. He promoted a sort of religion of reason. However, after his death, atheism started to fade in the rural areas of France. The common people rather met secretly to continue to worship during the year and a half that the churches were closed. It seemed more like the elites or the influential and those that were in the urban areas of the big cities were the ones who embraced the atheistic concept and they embraced the religion of reason and as a pendulum swing backlash against the abuses of Roman Catholicism with the aristocracy that they had suffered. Out in the countryside and the rural areas, it wasn't so bad because the friars and the parish priests were much more in touch with the people, not being part of the grander bourgeoisie scene in the large cities. But regardless, this was one of the reasons that led me not to accept the Louisville Notes conclusion that the 3.5 year war against the Bible was outlawed was not really particularly fact, because you could find that in February 21st, 1795, just 1 year and 4 months after the closing of churches, that they passed a decree that the churches were reopened. This was after Robespierre died. That's why I'm making the point. When Robespierre died in 1794, his extreme atheism and rejection of the Bible and all religion, as it were, started to fade. So there's a lot more to read about the French Revolution. That's just really very interesting on a variety of different ways, but not trying to get sidetracked, just trying to put this out there. The other aspect was with the Louisville notes, they rely on one translation to substantiate that in Revelation 11 verse 7, where it says, and when they shall have finished their testimony, they quote the concordant, which we like the concordant, that it says something like, sorry, this is not an exact quote, that they, when they are finishing their testimony, so that their 3.5 year, the war and the 3.5 year death doesn't have to follow at the end of the 1260 years. It can happen before the 1260 year period ends, sometime before that, while they are finishing, if you will. So that's why they have the 1260 years ending in 1799, but they have their 3.5 year period, from, November 23rd, 1793, and then expiring in June 17th, 1797. But there's only one translation that brings that out, and it doesn't mean that it has to be before it ends, the 1260 years, but it could be taken that way. However, what I've looked at in Strong's Concordance and others, they feel that that really is talking about finished at a fixed period of time at the ending. So I think that's probably why all the translations except that one seem to just have it, they finish their testimony. It just seems like the syntax of the language supports that. Also, as noted in the three pages of notes that we sent out and that you and I went over, you have to interpret your beast out of the sending out of the bottomless pit as something other than the papacy, because it was actually the papacy that was being put down in the French Revolution by and large. So you have to have a different beast out of that bottomless pit, and then that's going to affect your interpretation in the 17th chapter, as we talked about. So that's something to consider. The people of earth that dwell upon the earth, that rejoice over them, the earth, which is usually people under religious restraint, you have to have that interpreted as the people who believed in an atheism and the religion of reason is that earthly group. You have to interpret it for that. And this is the same time when there is a great earthquake. So on the one hand, you have the earth, society under religious restraint quaking in the French Revolution, but then you have the earth stable to, under the religion of reason, to be rejoicing that the Bible is abandoned in France for that period of time, because religion and the Bible had plagued the atheist point of view, largely because of the ill effect of papacy. So I have to leave that comments there. That's not the view I hold. I respect these brethren. And I'll just put it out there. Anyone who would like to comment further on that particular point of view, we're happy to entertain it. And if we're just going to leave it there in the mix, you could check out the Louisville Bible notes, Revelation notes on that at your leisure. Okay. So I'll leave that. So then let's consider this on our handout again, the diagram, if you will, please. We'll look at the second row of humps. And again, we look at the dating, and I'll work backwards again, just for ease, if you will. May 24th, 1530. The Roman Catholic bishops purchased New Testament in English to be publicly burned, and they had already purchased them, but then they burned them on that date. Considered to be the last purchased by Catholic bishops of William Tyndale's New Testament in English to be publicly burned, publicly humiliated. Some burnings continued of the Bible. Persecution of the Bible continued for a little bit longer in various ways, but it already, there was some movement shortly hereafter in the years after 1530 that, it was obvious the Bible in England couldn't be suppressed from the people. So we just back up half a year from May 24th, 1530. We back up to November 23rd, 1529, November 23rd, 1528, November 23rd, 1527 to November 23rd of 1526. That gets us back our 3.5 years. And, I put down, Roman Catholic bishops purchases New Testaments in English to be publicly burned. Actually, I should have wrote that better, more definitive. That wasn't a specific date that happened, but there was a decree that denounced the Bible and heretical writings that went out on October 24th, and a 30-day grace period, which would bring you to November 23. A 30-day grace period was allowed, but then you were to be excommunicated, the Bibles were to be rounded up and such. So they were trying to particularly trying to eradicate William Tyndale's New Testament in English that was coming from continental Europe and coming into England. So on that email, let's see, Brother Adi, did you have that email by chance? No, okay. Let me see, I gotta skip over here. Sister Alice, do you have that email by chance?
Is that the one with Frank Shalhoub?
Yeah. Could you read that number one for us, please?
Okay. Brother Frank Shalhoub, November 23rd, 1526, a decree in England for all English New Testaments, particularly William Tyndale's, to be turned in. Quoting documents found in Christopher Anderson's Annals of the English Bible, pages 118 and 119, citing Fox, who first wrote his books in 1562. Previously confiscated English New Testaments had been publicly burned at St. Paul's Cathedral on February 11, 1526. C.J.H. Murray Duaubney, History of the Reformation in the 16th Century, page 646 or 774, 775, and Anderson, page 106. April 27, 1527, bishops bought up English New Testaments to burn. Duaubney, page 661 or 793. May 1530, English New Testaments publicly burned, which had previously been purchased. Anderson, 262 and 263. Brother Frank's conclusion. November 23rd, 1526 until May 24th, 1530 is 3 years in 182 days.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for pronouncing, that French name so well. Any opening comment on this, Sister Alice?
Well, I think it's backing up the 3.5 years. Being in England, where the New Testaments were collected to be burned and then publicly burned, and starting in 1527 to 1530, being the 3 years, and then the 182 days. So I think that that's what you would be agreeing with, I'm thinking, that's all.
All right, yes, I am, that's true. Thank you, Sister Alice. I'll entertain your hand in 1 second, Sister Debbie. I just wanted to say that Christopher Anderson's Annals of the English Bible is fascinating. You can find it online and you can read it online. And it's very well set up to be able to navigate very quickly to your page as you wish. And so that's very good. And he has footnotes in it where he's quoting from Fox. Brother Fox lived in the 1500s, first wrote his books chronicling from historical records the persecution of Protestants by papists and by the civil government. That was his main work. And you and I think of like Fox's Book of Martyrs and such. But the books that he wrote on it, he goes to great length to give historical records of the day, papal records and different governmental records, to substantiate what was taking place against Protestants and against the Bible in the common language of the people. So that's very good. And D'Aubigne is a French writer, but he's not writing a commentary. His book is available. We happen to have that here. But he quotes different sources. But the thing is, neither Christopher Anderson nor D'Aubigne are commentators writing verse by verse, trying to offer you an interpretation. Frank is. Brother Frank is doing that, of course. But that's not what these writers are doing. So, okay. Sister Debbie. Covered it? Did I say what you were asking?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other comments? Okay. So, if you look back then at this graphic, okay, get that graphic ready, but Ruth?
I'm just thinking of these different alternatives. So the one that starts in 1526, November, was really a war against the Bible, particularly the New Testament. And then the one at the end of the French Revolution, or in 1793, seems to me like it was a war against the Catholic Church and not so much against the Bible. Would that be a true statement?
That's part of it. It was the reaction was against Christian religion and other religions by the atheists, and the Bible was included in their venom, their vehemence. But it's true, it was a war against Catholicism, mainly in France, and religion, whereas this was in the Reformation, this was a war against the Bible itself in the common language of the people. That's a fair statement, I think. Okay. So looking then at this graphic, a chart, the 1260 years, we have two scenarios. We try to just put it in a different way. The top one, the 1260 years starting in 539 AD, going to 1799. We're all very familiar with that. We put in that the French Revolution started in 1789. And then follows after the 1260 years, a 3.5 year period from 1800 to 1804, where there was a war, you know, with that view, there's a war against the Bible during that period, which we don't find. But we do have the end of the French Revolution. And during the French Revolution, there was a period of time where the Bible was suppressed when they closed the churches. That's true. But then we all readily see that there's a certain undoubtedly exaltation of the Bible with the Bible societies coming in 1804. Okay. Then the one underneath it on the bottom of the page, that 1260 year period, it has more of a ending date. If you look to the right, November 23rd, 1526, with the condemnation and the, for anyone having a Bible and the gathering of Bibles and Bible burnings had already started, that year in February 11th, which was documented, and led by the Catholic bishops. And you work backwards from November 23rd, 1526, 1260 years, and it brings you to AD 266. And that's a question mark because we don't have a significant event. You'll recall that we read it long ago now in the first volume and in a couple of reprints. Brother Russell allows for a 1260 year period from about 300 AD to the Reformation and the Bibles being put forth in mass in the common language to the people. And so we put in a couple more dates down there. We put in the Council of Nicaea in 325 and that the Latin Vulgate was written by Jerome, the New Testament, in 382 AD. And our prophecy talks about the two witnesses prophesying in sackcloth for 1260 years. So this actually, this demonstrates a little more closely to the two witnesses in sackcloth because that started in 382. But Brother Russell's point is actually it started earlier, about 300, with the abandonment of Bible authority being replaced by church council authority and church bishops and their interpretation and thinking. So without trying to, I'll just say a couple more things and then we'll just open it from there. With the view that Brother Shalhou is promoting here, the beast that comes out of the bottomless pit is a reference to the papacy as the ten-horned beast, and that it's a reference that it will ascend out of the pit in chapter 17, a future event. But it's an identifier. Just like saying the ten horns and seven heads is an identifier of the Roman Empire. Well, here, this is an identifier that this is the papal beast and that the papacy made war against the Bible at the time of the Reformation, particularly against it being in the common language of the people. And it's focusing particularly on the English translation of the New Testament by William Tyndale and that they were buying up the shipments that were coming from Europe of the English Bibles and they were burning them in public. And there were many burnings, not just a couple. And that the Bible in the common language of the people just lay on the streets of the great city. So it was not only in England, but it included in Europe that the papacy was against Luther's Bible in German. And as you and I read, over 23 different languages, the Bible was put into over 23 languages of the common people in the 1500s, primarily in the earlier part. And the papacy was against that until finally they had to do their own, with the Douay Rheims translation later. The people that rejoiced over the dead bodies was the Catholics. They rejoiced to have these giant book, Bible burnings. And along with any other heretical books, that is, books by Luther and eventually even by Tyndale. But it was the Bible itself in the common language which was the biggest threat to papacy. So then it's after those 3.5 year period, after 1530, that the papacy and actually even the advisors to Henry VIII, King of England, they were just seeing that the more they burned them, the more the people wanted them. And so they started changing tactics, as it were. And lo and behold, the King of England had his own reason to abandon papacy. As we all know, he wanted a divorce from the papist's wife, Catherine. And so he started his own Church of England. Even before that, he, in the process, his advisors were advising him to get the Bible in English into the churches of England, which they did, shortly hereafter. Now, I wanted to read a little bit just because I wanted it, whether this isn't like, I'm not reading it to just harp on my view. I'm not. But I just love it, and I know you love it too. This is called The Ancestry of Our English Bible. Ancestry of Our English Bible. It's written by Ira Maurice Price. He is a late professor of Semitic languages and literature at the University of Chicago. Now, I just want to read just a little bit. He's not spending a lot of time quoting sources, but his summation of events then, are, I thought, worth a few moments while we're on this. I'm reading from page 246. Tyndale found a welcome refuge in this hospitable city, that is Worms on the continent, and put his work into the hands of the printer Schoff. Cochlaeus had already sent to England a description of the work done in Cologne, so Tyndale laid it aside temporarily and first issued an octavo edition of 3,000 copies without either introduction or notes. Now that he's talking about his English New Testament. But this was soon followed by the edition begun in Cologne, which was in quarto with marginal notes. Both editions were shipped into England, hidden away in cases of merchandise. Being completed late in 1525, it is probable that they were in England early in 1526, for Edward Lee, Archbishop of York, who was then on the continent, wrote Henry VIII on the date of December 2nd, 1525. Quote, that an Englishman, at the solicitation and instance of Luther, with whom he is, hath translated the New Testament into English, and within 4 days intends to return with the same imprinted into England. I'm going to skip down. A German scholar by the name of Spalatinius in August of 1526 writes, among other things, the English, in spite of their active opposition of the king, were so eager for the gospel as to affirm that they would buy a New Testament even if they had to give 100,000 pieces of money for it. End of quote. As soon as Tyndale's English New Testament reached England, there was a great demand for it by the common people that they might read it and by the ecclesiastical authorities that they might burn it. Archbishop Warham issued a decree for its destruction. Bishop Tunstall added fuel to the fire. Decrees and denunciations, however, were of little avail to stay its popularity. By order of the ecclesiastical authorities, the books were bought up and burned in London, Oxford, and Antwerp, but without avail. The effective organization of distributors in England was supplied by numerous clandestine shippers from the continent. The fight was desperate. On the one side, to disseminate Tyndale's New Testament as widely as possible. On the other, to annihilate it. The bishops liberally contributed to buy up whole editions to consign them to the flames. And then he goes into all some instances and stories of how all this was taking place. I only have a couple short little more references. The fierceness and destructiveness of the opponents of Tyndale's translation systematically followed up and destroyed the thousands of copies that had been widely sold throughout England and Scotland. Of the estimated 18,000 copies printed between 1525 and 1528, just two are the only known fragments of those original printings by Tyndale. Out of 18,000, only two known fragments. And then I'm just skipping over another one sentence on page 250. Though the books were bought up and burned in quantities, they contributed greatly to the creation of an appetite for the Bible in English that could not be extinguished. And then lastly, on page 255, thus Henry VIII, who had proscribed Tyndale's New Testament in 1525, who apparently made no effort to save the life of its translator in 1536, that's when Brother Tyndale was burned at the stake, within 1 year after his martyrdom, within 1 year, Henry VIII authorized the sale and use of Tyndale's work, though under another name. Hence, by the influence of Cranmer, he was an advisor to Henry VIII, the cooperation of Cromwell, another advisor to Henry VIII, and the authorization of Henry VIII, the Matthew Bible was given free course on English soil, being a compilation, as it were, of Tyndale and Coverdale. It was the best English Bible in print. So I'll end there. I know, like you, we just love reading about our faithful brother Tyndale and what he gave his life for to get us the word. Whether you like it for the interpretation of this, we certainly rejoice in it. Sister Cindy.
What was the name of that book you were reading from?
The Ancestry of Our English Bible. The Ancestry of Our English Bible by Ira Price. Bartress.
Okay, so I just wanted to just a real quick basic recap. Tell me if I'm following along here. Revelation 11, 7 through 10 is focused on this 3.5 years, basically 1527-ish to 1530. And then verses 11 and 12 covers basically 260 years following 1530, where events bring the Bible to the people. And then verse 13 brings us to the French Revolution, 1789 to 1799. Is that generally what we've been talking about?
Well, that's the view of if you have that 1260-year period ending in the Reformation. Yes, the a little point of clarification, you said it well and right, but just to emphasize that in verse 11, after 3.5 days or 3.5 years, that's ending in our 15:30, the spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them. This is just bringing out that what I was reading about shortly after William Tyndale was even martyred in 1536, within a year, Henry VIII was authorizing the English Bibles to be available, and all these translations in the common language of the people throughout Europe and all, they were all blossoming and budding forth, and the Bibles became much more readily available in these languages. And so that was the rising up. And the fear that fell upon them, in my mind, equates to why the Roman Catholics made their own English Bible, the Old and New Testament, later on in the 1500s. That was yeah, 1582. Dropping its 1,000-year-old Latin only policy, the Church of Rome produces the first English Catholic Bible, the Reims New Testament, from the Latin Vulgate. And so that 1582. So that was the end, as it were, of the two witnesses prophesying in sackcloth. They were no longer restrained in Latin only, and then they were made plenteous in all these different common languages of the people. Even though, I want to say, even though papacy still said they prefer the Latin only, but they had to do it in English. But the process goes on to bring in verse 12 that the gradual rise and then the final exaltation to heaven was with the British Bible Society in 1804, which was a couple hundred years later. Yes. And that puts you about the time of the French Revolution. In other words, the French Revolution ended 1799, like we've talked about, and then within 3.5 years, we have the Bible societies and this great exaltation. So the verse 12, and that hour there was a great earthquake, relates to the final exaltation of the Bible to heaven with the Bible societies. So that was, that's that thinking along that lines. If that, Brother Chris, a follow up on how you were outlining it?
No, I just wanted to get that, 11 and 12 time frame, right in my mind, that there's, how it brings us up to date, that we haven't even got to the end of 13, where it says, and gave glory to the God of heaven, which I think is papacy, not the Heavenly Father. That's the note I have. But we haven't even talked about that yet. So, over.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And that is so twisted. How Napoleon got the Pope back after he imprisons him and has him die in prison. He brings the Pope back and reinstitutes the Inquisition so they could be made an emperor. It's so weird. But yeah, that's a counterfeit God. And that's true. We need to get to that, to help round out our thinking. That's why we say, brethren, just put your notes on a yellow pad and not in the margin of your Bible until you are convinced and hear all the pros and cons. Sister Debbie.
Okay, I got 259 years. It's like in verse 11, it says, after the 3.5 years, the Spirit of God enters into them, and they hear a great voice, and they go up. And the same hour was there a great earthquake. It's that and the same hour, because you're saying that if you use 1530 as being the end of the 3.5 years, and that they were brought back to life and raised to heaven in the interim before the French Revolution. I'm kind of that in the same hour. That's kind of confusing me. And the time between 1530 and the French Revolution started in 1789, so that makes 259 years. So I'm just a little, you know, is that the same hour? That's, I guess maybe that is what get, are we saying an hour is this, is 259 years or? Okay. That's what I have to leave it because I'm confused. Over.
No, it is confusing. And you're asking a good question. The word same is not in the Greek. So in Revelation 11 verse 13, that word same is not in the Greek. It's better reads, and that hour was there a great earthquake. Now, to most of us, that's not going to make a big difference whether the word same is there or not, but I am clarifying that. But that hour of the great earthquake is relating to the exaltation in the cloud, and the enemies beheld them. Not their coming back to life. The coming back to life was back in the Reformation, after the Bible was so bitterly burned and persecuted, actually was embraced by the very ones who had been persecuting it. And that took place in the Reformation. But it was a gradual rise till when finally in, with the Bible societies in 1804, about that hour of the French Revolution, it was exalted so that anyone, could find a Bible at a reasonable cost. So yes, it's a progress. 11 to 12 to 13, shows a progression. Whether that appeals to one's mind or not, that's going to be part of each one of our decision making, Sister Debbie.
So it's saying that it was, ascended up to heaven. Is that the heaven of the Roman Catholic Church? In other words, when they started deciding that they were going to put out their Bible or something? Or is that,
the ascending to heaven would be the Bible societies. Sorry for cutting in. Okay. The ascending to heaven would be the Bible societies in 1804 onward. But the spirit of life entering into them and they're standing on their feet, that was back after the 3.5 year persecution of the English New Testament and the other Bibles. And like I say, the enemies of the Bible, the papists, they were so shocked and fear fell upon them, they made their own English New Testament and Old Testament, the way Reims in the 1500s, latter 1500s, as part of the Counter-Reformation. Brother Frank uses a picture. And again, it doesn't necessarily would appeal, but as Jesus was God, the Word of God, and he had a 3.5 year ministry, and his enemies made war against him and put him to death, and he was in the grave, parts of 3 days. Then when he was resurrected, he stayed in Earth's atmosphere for 40 days, seen only by those who were his believers and disciples. And after that 40-day period, he ascended up in the sight of his disciples and entered into his glory. So Brother Frank is just drawing out a little picture that there was a time lapse between Jesus coming to life and then ascending. And it's true. It's a very short period of time in comparison. But it was of interest. And like I say, it's just, you know, I'm not suggesting that should convince anybody one way or the other, But I think more, for my mind, it's what really happened historically and how can we fit it in. And it's all taking place during this sixth trumpet period, either view you have. And both are reasonable in their own ways. Some harmonize some elements better than others. That's really what it boils down to. How does all the elements harmonize best for one? Sister Debbie, your hand still up? Anyone else want to comment on any of this so far? Okay. Brother Mark Campbell.
So you were saying that the Tyndale was the basis of the Matthew Bible? That was, they had almost got rid of all the Tyndale translations, and then they, Henry VIII came up with putting together the Matthew Bible. Is that what you said?
No. So, go ahead.
So is the Matthew Bible actually an improvement over the Tyndale Bible, or was it just about as close as they could get to the Tyndale Bible? And the other part of the question is the English version that the Catholics came up with, I forgot the name of that Bible. It's not Douay, was it?
The New Testament was Reims.
Oh, Reims.
And the Old Testament came a few years later, was Douay.
Oh, okay.
So they sometimes call it the Reims Douay or the Douay Reims if they've got the Old and New Testament in it.
Okay. Now, do you know of any specific changes that were in those Catholic version in contrast to the, say, the Matthew Bible? Like, did they change it? You said it had something to do with Counter-Reformation. So how would that have, what would they have changed to make it more favorable to the Catholics?
Okay, that's a great question. And I have to say that I, during the last month or so in researching this, I was reading in books and online about the development of the English Bible. And it's remarkable how many different writers came up with their own version of the English Bible. And some better than others, but to answer your first question first, the in the annals, the ancestry of our English Bible on that page 255, I'll reread. Thus Henry VIII, who had proscribed Tyndale's New Testament in 1525, who apparently made no effort to save the life of its translator in 1536, within 1 year after his martyrdom authorized the sale and use of Tyndale's work, though under another name. Hence, by the influence of Cranmer, the cooperation of Cromwell, and the authorization of Henry VIII, the Matthew Bible was given free course on English soil, being a compilation, as it were, of Tyndale and Coverdale. It was the best English Bible in print. So there's a lot you can read on it, but I hope that kind of answers that initial question. I did read elsewhere, not that I could put my finger on it, that the majority of the King James Bible of 1611 was based on Tyndale's work. Regarding the Douay Reims, I can't specifically say different scriptural interpretation on the Greek or Hebrew words, But we can say that the way Reams included their notes, Catholic favored notes for interpreting what you were reading on a verse. And that comes into play. So they, the Catholics, even though they printed the Bible in English, a Catholic authorized, they put their notes in it to be read with the translation. And they made it known that they still favored the Latin Bible for use. So, okay, Brother Dan.
Along those lines, Brother Rick, I was looking at my Catholic Bible, and along with their notes, it has a large introduction by the Pope himself that basically warns them about reading the Bible and understanding it differently than the experts, which are the popes and the bishops and the priests. And they encourage people to read it in one sense by saying you'll get indulgences for reading, for a certain amount of time or something along those lines. So just, because they had to provide a Bible because the people were at that time, they were wanting it. So it was in defense of the Catholic Church and keeping people from the truth the best they could, that they printed their own Bible, but they had these great cautions and used fear to keep people from really reading it with their own spectacles, if you will, to see what the scriptures were actually saying. Over.
Okay, very good. Yes, thank you. Go ahead. Ruth.
Well, according to Wikipedia, the Douay Rheims is translation from the Latin Vulgate. It's not from the Hebrew and Greek like Tyndale's was, and eventually the King James was. Over.
Yes, that's an excellent point. William Tyndale was fluent in seven ancient languages, including Greek and Hebrew and Latin. But if you are interested and you look into any research on the English Bible, Erasmus put together a Greek text, and that was considered the basis for much of William Tyndale's work on the Greek New Testament. The difference between Erasmus and Tyndale was that Erasmus did not put it into English, so he avoided the persecution. William Tyndale took the Greek text, put it into English, and he sustained the persecution. That's why we don't hear so much about Erasmus. But when you look at him up, he was very influential in getting the Greek New Testament together. And it's certainly a very prominent figure in the history of the development of the English Bible.